You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, not being famous. Oh, Waitrose attracts the wrong sort of customer. The Guardian is going to cost you more. Oh, ka-ching. Everybody, slow down. Life and Benefits Street reviewed, and two stonking tracks are added to the pretend iPod.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Parish Council, the podcast from the Rocking Vicar, and you're very welcome. I'm Magnus Shaw, and he was made for loving you, baby, and you were made for loving him. It's my colleague, Terence Dacham.
Hello, Magnus Shaw. Hello.
Hi.
Well, here's the thing, Magnus Shaw. Mm-hmm. It's not often I get to talk about my celebrity status.
There's a good reason for that.
I'm sure you'll forgive me if I tell you a story of an incident that happened to me this week. Mm-hmm. It was potentially even more celeb-tastic, as the incident happened in front of my mother, so I thought, oh, she'll be impressed by this. take your mother to lunch day earlier this week. Me taking your mother to lunch.
Yeah, she'd appreciate that.
It may happen one day, but I was actually taking my mother to lunch. And after lunch, I took her for her traditional pot of tea at a posh Surrey hotel. It's sort of traditional after lunch. And after an hour or so, I went off to get the car and bring it round to the door so she didn't have to walk too far in the tricky conditions, as we know, earlier this week. And as I returned to the front of the hotel and I was opening the door of the car for my mother to get in, this woman strode over and said, "Hey, I've been watching you." And initially I thought I was about to be told off about something. But she seemed a bit eccentric, so I just smiled. And then she said, "I knew it was you. My daughter went outside to get a better look at you." And then she said, "Yeah, seriously." Yeah. And then she said, "You're the actor. We've seen you." So I thought, oh, good, my mother's here to see this. She can hear this woman and her daughter sort of sing my praises, you know. So I said, I do act a bit. Mainly I'm a writer, but lovely. And she said, "Yes, my daughter will be back in a moment. She'd love a photo. We loved you in The Vice." And that's when the whole thing began to fall apart, because I've never been in anything called The Vice. I don't even know what it is.
From 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah. I see. So I sort of explained this, and it was a kind of odd moment, because I could see her face almost literally drop in front of me. She said, "Oh dear, you look just like him," and she was so disappointed. Yeah. We didn't need to wait for her daughter to come back. They didn't want a photo, and my moment of fame was very short lived.
Have you consulted YouTube to try and find an actor in The Vice who?
Do you know, I haven't. I must do that. Yeah. Well, the Vice. Yeah, see if there's someone who looks like me.
Yeah, Leo McKern, maybe.
Friends of mine who are genuinely famous, they tell me the same thing. That I often hear the same thing when they say being famous is great for about, it's enormous fun for about the first year.
Yeah.
When, especially if you've got your mum with you. "Oh, yes, of course, old son. Yes, a photo, And mum, just sit there for a moment. I won't be long. It's fabulous." But then it becomes the most tiresome thing ever in the history of the world when you're simply just going about your day-to-day life. Not a film premiere or something, but just having a coffee in a hotel or a drink in a pub or, shopping in the supermarket. And I hear that from so many famous people.
Don't all these encounters start with the words, "It's you, isn't it?"
Yeah, I imagine they probably do.
And then when your stock starts to sink a bit, people say, "Didn't you used to be?"
Oh, imagine that, yeah. I was going to say, I may have mentioned this before, but the one exception that I've come across was Ken Dodd, just by sheer chance, I was just coming back on a train from Waterloo towards Staines, and he was on the train and he was sitting opposite me. And instead of, hiding behind a newspaper or affecting not to to be kindled. He kind of gave a whole routine to the carriage while we were on the train from Waterloo to Staines. And as I was sitting opposite him, he said, "Oh, you know, where are you going?" I said, "Oh, I'm going to get off at Staines." And that led to a sort of 20-minute routine about Staines. So, you know, the rain in Staines stays mainly in the Thames. You know, it's a Lady of Staines, I adore you. And all this, yeah. And he revelled in
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he's just like an old trooper, you know. What did he used to say? You can tell a pro because when they open the fridge door, they do 15 minutes.
Yes. Well, that exactly. That was Ken Dodd. He almost seemed to welcome the fact that there were people in this enclosed space with him, and he essentially got a sort of 40-minute comedy routine from Waterloo to Staines.
Well, I was once on a late-night train Nottingham to Derby, I think, many years ago, early 80s, and all sat in the carriage, a bit tired, quite, you know, silent, and everybody minding their own business. And this woman appeared at the end of the carriage, very sort of melodramatically, goes, shh, shh, shh. She says to everybody, listen, everybody listen to me. So everyone looks up, what the hell's this? She goes, come with me, everybody come with me. Dickie Davis is in this carriage.
Oh, my God, Dickie Davis.
Like, we were all going to, you know, it was a fairly big train, last train to Derby sort of thing. And she wanted us all to come with her to the next carriage to go and look at Dickie Davis.
I think that endorses the point, doesn't it? That, you know, probably for the first year of being Dickie Davis from World of Sport was fabulous. But then when you're just on a late night train trying to get home, you probably had a full day of filming and you've got some woman saying, "Is Dickie Davis through there?" Exactly. It'd be hell on earth.
But
hell on earth.
Then again, it's in the job description, isn't it? You know, we all have parts of our jobs that we don't really much enjoy and that might be the in the small print of being famous.
Yes, I suppose so. So beware all ye who strive for fame, right. I suppose. Yeah. I tell you what, Magnus Shaw, I remember you telling us once, many podcasts ago, where you go for your weekly shop. But I've forgotten the name of the supermarket. Was it Iceland? Or that probably the Socialist Cooperative, was it?
Oh, which it was. No, if there was a socialist cooperative supermarket, I'd be going to it, absolutely. But no, it's the boring one that begins with a T, of course.
T. T. Oh, there you go. My God, I was slow there. Yeah. Well, we know that you receive perks from that particular supermarket, Tesco, but just over 2 years ago, Waitrose introduced a loyalty card, which they say gives their customers instant offers rather than collecting points towards money off vouchers, like indeed the Tesco Club card, which is mentioned. One of the offers is a free cup of tea or coffee to all loyalty card holders every day. And this has led, in the 2 years that this scheme has been running, in 2 years, Waitrose has become the second largest coffee provider in the UK.
But the first least profitable, perhaps.
Well, maybe so. Yeah. That's what I'm going to ask you, because only McDonald's sells more coffee or indeed gives more coffee away. But Waitrose shoppers are rebelling. On Waitrose's Facebook page, customers are complaining that people, and I must say the wrong sort of people, are coming into Waitrose with a couple of cards, getting their free drinks, not shopping, and then cluttering up the cafe area for hours at a time. Another Facebooker, Penny Claydon, said on the Waitrose Facebook page, she said, "Waitrose is turning into a soup kitchen, handing out free drinks." And others report the sighting of chavs, literally using that word. So is this, in marketing terms, a good idea gone wrong, or will Waitrose still see it as a sort of loss leader?
Well, I mean, this is when you make a straight out, you know, this is free offer, then you can't discriminate over who takes part in it. It just seems extraordinary that people would, you know, this is first world problem writ large, isn't it? That people would take to the internet to complain about the kinds of people who are taking
the
advantage
of
this.
The wrong sort of people, actual quote.
And presumably, you know, if the cafe was full of upper middle class people with their free coffee, then people wouldn't, you know, the complainers wouldn't have taken to Facebook to express their dismay. The problem with referring to your fellow citizens as the wrong kind of people, is how can you be sure you're the right kind of person? How can you be absolutely certain that somebody isn't complaining about you as the wrong kind of person?
It's very philosophical.
Well, I think in the supermarket wars, everybody's looking for an edge, and this is the edge for Waitrose. There's nothing they can do. They can either withdraw the free tea or coffee offer in its current form, or they can accept that it's going to bring all sorts of people to the store, which is presumably what, in essence, that they want. I suppose they've missed a trick. They could say, on production of your loyalty card and a receipt dated today. Mm. That's probably what one would do, is just, to eliminate the people who never shop. So I'd say, your loyalty card plus today's receipt, and you get yourself a coffee. But you cannot do is have some kind of bouncer system where somebody looks you up and down and says, good God, what are you doing here? And leave. And
yes, a velvet rope.
Yes, exactly. I'm appalled anybody would go online and talk about the wrong kind of people using their supermarket. That's disgusting.
I visited a local Waitrose yesterday in the spirit of research, and my entirely unscientific have a glance round survey actually did suggest a high proportion of older people reading the free newspapers and lingering over tea and coffee whilst eating biscuits or crisps out of a handbag, I noticed.
Well, good for them. Good for them. So why not? Why not indeed?
To be fair, Mark Price, he's the managing director of Waitrose. He told the Daily Telegraph in the week that, it was actually not in the week, just before Christmas, he gave this quote, that he doesn't mind if some people pop in only for the free tea and coffee, but he rather more wanted to point out in this interview that about their new facilities in their Kingston store, Kingston upon Thames, where they now have a free wine tasting area and a tapas bar.
Oh, okay.
That's very Middle England, isn't it? But I thought the free wine tasting, again, might bring in people who they might not want to be in the store.
How on earth do you qualify for that?
Ah, I know. The only thing with your receipt idea, it just occurred to me. I mean, it sounds a good idea in theory, but if you did all your shopping and you had particularly frozen goods, you're not going to want to leave that trolley there while all your frozen goods unfreeze you have your free tea or coffee.
So you're going to miss what a small latte.
But you may want it before you shop, I suppose.
Get a lid put on it. Drink it in the car.
Perhaps so. Maybe our health and safety people would have a word to say about that. This waitress business is rather a different experience to Iceland or Lidl, I suspect, where I don't think you do get your free tea or coffee. Of course, in Waitrose, you get a free newspaper if you spend over £5 as well.
Oh, right, okay. Well,
that's quite a good one.
Yes. But of course, there's no such thing as a free lunch, and all these schemes are built into the price of the goods in the store. So you're probably paying a quid more for, or should we say, an eat-at-home curry in Waitrose than you are in a store that doesn't give you free tea and coffee. So you're paying for it somewhere anyway. That's presumably why they don't really mind you taking advantage of it.
I suppose you're right. Well, whilst Waitrose are giving away this free tea and coffee, and, as I say, the free newspaper if you spend over £5 in the store, your Guardian newspaper, along with the Times, has just put an increase on the cover price again. Monday to Saturday, the cost of the Guardian will increase by 20 pence, making the weekday edition £1.60, and the Saturday Guardian a whopping £2.50. Though you will receive a new lifestyle supplement, but I think this is a bit of window dressing because the previously separate money supplement now morphs into the main body of the paper. A spokeswoman for The Guardian said, "Our continued investment in print is being welcomed by our readers. So, Magna Shaw, if you bung in The Observer on a Sunday, that would be £13.20 per week." Is that anonymous spokeswoman right? Do you welcome this investment in print?
Well, nobody welcomes a price rise in something that they buy frequently, do they? Mm. That goes without saying. I buy The Guardian on a Saturday, and maybe it says something about my slow-moving intellect, but that takes me all week to read. So, £2.
So you don't buy it during the week?
No,
sorry,
I don't. No.
Oh, I see.
And that's a long train journey, and I've forgotten my book or a Kindle or whatever. That's my sort of default. I've got nothing to read, is to go and buy The Guardian. But on the whole, I just buy it on a Saturday, and it takes me all week to read that. I mean, not solidly, not 8 hours a day every day for a week, but
the government spokesman said
it takes all week for my mum to read it to me.
Yeah.
but of course, it does rather speak to a bigger problem, doesn't it? If a publication is having to, you know, rather frequently raise its cover price, then it suggests something is badly wrong with the business model. And I think we spoke last year, didn't we, about the eye-watering amount of money being lost at The Guardian on a daily basis. I'm not sure putting up the cover price is anything more than a sticking plaster over that, or indeed might turn out to be an even bigger liability for them. The Guardian's problem, and it's sort of insoluble now, is that they made the decision a good few years ago to give away all their content on the internet and then expect people to pay for it on a piece of paper. I'm not sure that was the wisest thing they ever did.
Well, indeed, but I'd like to throw another element into the mix about, perhaps where some money could be saved. Alan Rusbridger, the Guardian editor, he received £471,000 in pay in 2009. Now, he has since agreed to a pay cut, and he now receives £395,000 per year. And I worked out that even with the price rise, that's equivalent to 246,875 copies of The Guardian.
Yes.
That seems to me to be rather a lot of money to be. I'm sorry to be sort of quite personal about Mr. Rusbridger, but it seems an incredible amount of money to pay to an editor that of a newspaper that, you know, were it not for the Scott Trust bailing it out year on year on year, would be out of business.
Yes, absolutely. Paul Dacre's just taken a pay hike, hasn't he, to £4 million annually, but his paper is in profit. Largely due to its website, I think, but it's perhaps, this is always the problem, isn't it, with a large organisation which is hemorrhaging money, is do you continue to invest in the salary of the people at the top, you know, on the basis that they're best placed to turn the situation around, or do you get rid of them and bring in somebody cheaper who may be less skilled turning publications around? But I guess if Alan Rusbridger was going to turn The Guardian around, he'd have done it. So I do take your point.
How do you feel about Alan Rusbridger's daughter working at The Guardian under an assumed name, her mother's maiden name, to avoid accusations of nepotism? She works on Comment Is Free.
I think it's a shame that she does it under an assumed name, because it immediately starts to make the whole thing look shady, which it isn't necessarily. I'd be an enormous hypocrite to criticise anybody for using their position to find opportunities for their nearest and dearest, because none of my children work for me, but they all did work experience at companies that I was part of when they were in the sixth form and had to find work experience placements. And I would, it would have been some kind of ogre that said, I'm not going to help you with this. You're there to help your kids, aren't you? So.
I'd make a difference there. I think work experience is reasonable, although there is still an element of unfairness to it. It's not even in the same league as actually having a paid job.
Yeah.
At the company, and you just one woman would want, I don't know, maybe his daughter was independently interviewed on a, you know, with a on a panel by, and doing, you know, she competed against 50 others on the shortlist and was the best for the role, as far as I know. But
I dislike nepotism as much as the next guy, but I think you have to be careful to look at yourself and think, well, if my son or daughter had just graduated and was working in a chicken shop, but what they really wanted to do was be, I don't know, a chartered engineer, and I was the head of a chartered engineering company, what would I do? Mm. You know, you can see why people do it, because their instinct is to do whatever they can to you know, help their children.
And my final shot on that would be even then that there would be a mild element of understanding of that if The Guardian was making millions per day instead of hoovering up and, you know, draining millions.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't look good, and it doesn't help the Guardian's position morally or philosophically. But I can see why that would happen. It's just that by doing it under an assumed name, it immediately says we shouldn't be doing this. So.
Well, yes, that tells its own story. Yep. And essentially, what we're saying to the newspapers is make hay while that sun still shines, albeit that the sun is now rather low in the sky.
Twilight. I think with the, you know, as with a lot of titles, the inevitable denouement is an entirely digital title. And it's just a matter of who's going to grasp that nettle first. Suddenly, you've got enormous resources because you don't have a print run to manage. So,
well, perhaps these newspaper editors will soon be forced by circumstance to take life a little bit more easily and put their feet up. I was listening to Radio 4 the other day, and I was intrigued by a feature about the slow movement. It's an international campaign challenging the cult of speed. So I decided to look into the background of this idea, and I found that it came to prominence in Italy in the 1980s, mainly to encourage people to eat more slowly. And this has led to a worldwide take-up of doing everything in life more slowly. Travel, parenting, fashion, and so on. And I actually tried this during the week. I had what could have been a journey to hell. I was going to IKEA in Croydon, and I took the inside lane of the M25 when I went there. And I've been trying to eat more slowly as well this week, and it does have a calming effect. So I say, slow down, Magnus Shaw. Slow down.
I think one of these things that on paper, it seems like a terrific idea. We'd all like to live slightly slower lives. In practice, how does that fly? Morning, boss. You know what? I thought I'd get the later train today. So I thought I'd come in an hour and a half later. The later train stops at more stations, and it's all part of my scheme to take life more slowly. It doesn't really wash, does it?
Well, actually, that's funny you say that, because the travel element, the slow movement, recommend that you get to know places you're traveling through. And do you know what I was thinking about? You're talking about, you know, the slow train and stopping at places. Do you know what it made me think of? This is what I was going to get a reaction from you. Remember you've had these couple of trips through to the States where it's like a driving holiday, and you drive from this place to that place to that place. Now, first of all, I thought, well, is that the very element that they're talking about? But of course, what you do when you do those tours is you don't stop long enough in places to get to know them.
No, you don't. You get it's a snapshot journey, inevitably, unless you have 6 months to do it in. You have to spend at most a couple of days.
So my question is, do you ever sort of think, you know, I mean, I would love to do it, and as you know, I intend to do the West Coast one. But do you ever sort of think, as you leave Santa Barbara, oh, I wish I could have spent, you know, another day or so there, just, you know, walking slowly round the town?
Absolutely, at every place, yes. But you also think, God, I never thought I'd see Santa Barbara, and now I have. And guess what? Tonight, I'm going to be in wherever, Santa Cruz or Los Angeles or wherever. And so it's those kind of trips are all about the excitement of seeing so many places in one fell swoop. They're not about exploring every destination intimately.
They say, parenting is to allow children to enjoy unorganized adventures, fashion by fewer clothes, slow church. That seems like a perfect place to stop for me, even if not in a religious sense, just the slow down of contemplation, quite like that. But like you, I can see problems, you know, like slow down shopping in Waitrose or Tesco's, when every shopper is, you know, bashing you with their trolley, yeah, and you're just going, hey, you know, I just sort of meander down this. Slow down boarding of London tube trains. Yeah, try that on a Monday morning at 8:30. Yes. Yeah. And slow down Olympics, where Usain Bolt has to take the longest time to reach 100
meters.
Yeah,
that would be brilliant. A slow Olympics would be brilliant. Yeah. That would be terrific.
They'd still be running now, you know, from the last year's 2012 Olympics.
Yeah, not
they'd
running. Still be sort not of, running, of
no,
course. No.
Meandering.
Yeah. It all sounds terrific. But it's something we'd have to adopt en masse globally, isn't it, for it to really have any traction. Either that, or you could only adopt it if you're the sort of idle rich who can do exactly what you choose to do. Otherwise, I'm afraid the world insists that we do it all in a hurry, and we can't escape that, really.
Yes, I know. It's a terrible shame.
Yeah, it is.
I've talked a bit about sort of meditation and retreats that I've been to. Well, on one of the retreats that I've been to, you do walking meditation and you pick a spot, perhaps on a lawn or something like that. Yeah. It doesn't really matter. And you pick a spot only, I don't know, 5 yards ahead of you. And you just walk really slowly to that point, sort of just contemplating, clearing your mind, you know, mindfulness through breathing, everything. And then you just walk back and you just keep doing that. And, you know, just describing it like that sounds a bit bonkers. And, you know, you think, well, God, I'm going to get bored with that within about 2 minutes. But when I actually did it, I found that when I sort of thought, well, I'll stop now, something like an hour and 15 minutes had gone by. And I thought it was maybe 10 minutes,
oh, really?
15
yeah,
minutes,
yeah.
Because you get so absorbed in it. And you start looking, and again, I know I'm going to sound like an old hippie here, but you start looking at like every blade of grass. And even from the, you know, being 6 foot higher than the blade of grass, somehow your focus gets really sharpened and you just notice little nuances and little things. And suddenly time just escapes.
Yeah,
and
the other thing I can sort of compare that with is last year on my birthday, actually 2 years now on my birthday, I was lucky enough to wake up on my birthday at the Grand Canyon.
Ooh.
Which is a pretty great birthday morning, really. And I got up at about 6:45 and went straight to the ridge of the canyon, freezing, by the way, but nevertheless a brilliant way to spend your birthday morning. And so we went to a lay-by all along the ridge of the Grand Canyon. There are little viewpoints where you can pull over, no fee for parking, and you can see the canyon from a particular angle. And we were fortunate enough to pull into one of these viewpoints. At that time in the morning, nobody there. There was absolutely nobody there. And we had the Grand Canyon to ourselves. This is myself and my wife. And initially we just pointed at things. But then we fell into silence just sort of by inclination, and it just seemed appropriate for, and we just stood there and we stared into the Grand Canyon as the sun got higher and higher slowly over the canyon and the shadows changed and all the rest of it. And I could have done that for 3 days. Could have just stood there as long as nobody else turned up, and just every now and again a bird would squawk, and that was the only sound. It was stock still. There was no wind, there was no rain, and it was sort of like being frozen in a moment in time. And that was very, very,
I think that's exactly what I was describing. It's a very similar experience. You know, that,
and you started to notice, I hadn't seen that rock a moment ago. Oh yeah, that rock touches that rock, and you get really absorbed. And it's sort of like being stoned, but cheaper.
I'm not sure if we could describe it as a slow pace of life, but many of the people featured on Channel 4's Benefit Street this week certainly adopt an alternative way of life. There's been an enormous response, of course, to the airing of this programme this week, with many of the residents complaining that they've been exploited and were misled about the intention of the programme. Benefit Street featured residents of James Turner Street in Birmingham, a total of 99 houses where a very large number of people are in receipt of state benefits. We saw residents involved in taking drugs, consuming vast amounts of alcohol, shoplifting, and many in turmoil about the government's spare room subsidy. Did this show Benefit Street have you boiling in rage at these slackers, Owen Jones? Not Owen Jones, Magna Shaw.
Well, I really thought how refreshing to see such a determined television expose of wealthy corporate elites and the devious methods they use to squirrel billions of pounds into offshore shell companies to avoid paying an appropriate level of tax. It wasn't that. In fact, it was just another Ian Duncan Smith wet dream, poverty erotica for the Tut Brigade, scratching around for evidence of a voluminous population of feckless lower class crooks and cheats to support their belief that the country is rife with work-shy benefits dependents. Unfortunately, I would say Benefit Street is as irresponsible and unhelpful as it is prurient and divisive.
Well, but you see, none of the people that were featured, they weren't acting. They actually said those words. They actually did those things. This is reality on this particular street, whether it is a prime example of life in every town, in every street where people are on benefit. It is, of course, hard to take further. But, you know, they actually were shoplifting. They actually were taking drugs. And indeed, in some cases, getting uppity about the government's spare room subsidy, because in that spare room, they had a cannabis farm growing, and it meant that, you know, this had to come to an end. So I don't think, you know, we can deny that these things go on. And I must say, I didn't see much talk from those featured about their job-seeking activities. Indeed, a lady called Becky said, "There'll be riots if we don't get paid." And that phrase resonated to me. Paid. It's benefits. It's not pay. They're not wages that people get when they go to work. It's benefits. And none of the people featured, okay, it may have been edited indeed to not show this, but I didn't see any job-seeking activities.
No, nobody's suggesting that what was portrayed was a fictional, although obviously edited, all programmes are, or B, desirable. But the point is, the implication and certainly the inference that people self-evidently have taken away from that is that this is a cross-section of everybody who uses the welfare state. And
I don't think they were saying that.
They didn't say it explicitly, but they said it implicitly. Because if this is an extreme example, where was the commentary to say that these are just extreme examples? Obviously, most people who take advantage of the benefits to which they're entitled are not like this. In fact, most people in receipt of benefits are either pensioners who paid for their own pension, or B, in work and receiving support for either low wages or high rents.
I believe it's 50% pensioners, 25% in work benefits. Quite. But it's that other 25% that troubles me. We had this chap with the unusual nickname Fungi or Fungi, who said he was too ill to work. He was on disability benefits, fair enough. But he wasn't too ill to undertake odd jobs for his neighbours, for which he was remunerated. I think actually one would say being exploited, but there we are. And I'm not so sure it was a demolition job, because we saw this, one of the main characters. Now, if you didn't see the programme, it's not me with these descriptions. It was themselves describing themselves as white D and black D, yeah. Depending on the colour of their skin. Obviously, one had white skin, but one was black skin. White D, she was sort of shown as rather self-styled, it must be said, sort of matriarch of the street and advising her fellow residents, although I thought her advice was very, very ill-advised. Her advice to one person was to ignore any letters from officialdom in relation to benefits, and do you know what I mean, was her catchphrase. So, you know, she was shown, I think, you know, as someone pulling the street together and holding it all together in the face of all that was going on around them. Then transpires, as shown in the papers this week, that her real name, Deirdre Kelly, is a convicted criminal who stole more than £13,000 from the city council that employed her, and it included envelopes of cash that was given to social workers to look after by vulnerable tenants. And we saw her in this programme looking after cash for this fungi guy. So, wasn't shown in the programme. That's come out since. And I think the other lady, the other D, currently on bail for a variety of issues incorporating drugs and other legal issues. So, you know, and that wasn't shown in the programme. I think those aspects were supposed to be sympathetic. Mark and Becky, we saw Becky was the one who said that, you know, she would riot if she didn't get paid. Mark and Becky got caught fiddling their benefit. They were quite upfront about that. They admitted it on the show. No guilt at all, quite prepared to continue risking it. It seemed to me that it showed that every opportunity to rob anything from anyone had to be taken.
You're mistaking my criticism of the show for a defence of the people that we saw. That's not what I'm suggesting. I think anybody is suggesting that the lifestyles we saw in the show were desirable for anybody. And indeed, most people seem to be desperately unhappy. My point is if this is a documentary about life on benefits, it's not a balanced documentary. And there's ample evidence that the program was portrayed by the producers to the people being filmed as an examination of a street in Birmingham, that benefits didn't come into it. And this was the spin that was put on it in the edit and in the titling of the program. Benefits has become, thanks to the media and the political class, what they call a hot potato. Mm-hmm. It's what everybody's talking about, everybody's scratching their heads about. It's also an enormous scapegoat for the failings of the economic classes. And a program like this, therefore, has an added responsibility to paint a rounded picture. So to cut through the propaganda and display some truth. It didn't do that. It displayed a microcosm, a granule of truth in such a way that it was terribly easy to stomp away, objecting loudly and hypocritically about the welfare state. That is my problem with it.
Well, yes, but I do still think it's worth showing, even in within that sort of perimeter, because even if it is an extreme, it's worth showing to say, well, this is actually going on. It's not the norm, and we know, you know, a lot of people are actively trying to find work who have, you know, most unfortunately found themselves in those circumstances, and you know, that's not really what I'm focusing on, because it could happen to any of us. I'm not that sort of unfeeling and sort of patronising to not realise that, you know, we're all just a short journey away from those sort of circumstances. But what I think it did show, and maybe we'll agree on this, I don't know, is the failure of, if you like, the system. But by that I mean parenting, for a start, both the parents of all the adults featured, and then my fear, the children shown. I think the couple that I referred to, their children were shown sort of meandering around and taking all of this anti-authority, anti-the man, anti-establishment views into place, where it's then shown as an example to these youngsters, and I'm talking about very young children, that if you have any kind of interaction at all with the police or the education authorities or anybody with any semblance of what might be seen to be power, but I mean in the sense of someone with authority or with an element of respectability, I suppose, then you should be against them. You must rebel against them, and they're out to get you. So teachers, the police, local authorities, councils, they're out to get you. And that's the message, I think, that is being given to the young children. And I think that's the failure, because their children will then grow up the same, and we've got a repetitive, a cycle, if you like, of benefit dependency and anti-police, anybody, teachers, educationalists, shopkeepers, indeed, yes, how to shoplift.
But I say again, no, I don't hear anybody leaping to the defence of the lifestyles that we saw. My criticism is that this is a quick win for London-based middle-class media companies to grab some ratings. It's tabloid television. I don't like tabloid newspapers on the whole, and I don't like tabloid television, but this is tabloid television dressed up as social documentary. And it isn't it. We've covered this adequately, more than adequately. You talk about balance. We've had a show called Skint. We've had a show called On Benefits and Proud. And there was another show, the title escapes me, that took a similar life. People Like Us, it was called.
People Like Us,
we've
that's
been
right,
here. Yeah. We've done this. It's cynical in that it is seen to be well, so we get more of it. And it is... You know, it's as lazy as it is irresponsible. And, you know, where are the documentaries about the white-collar workers, you know, conspiring with their accountants to shift profits to places where they'll be invisible, which is just as damaging, just as unhealthy, and just as despicable as what we've seen in the lifestyles of these rather, you know, tragic people.
I agree with that. I suppose, you know, I, without wanting to repeat myself, just saying it is of value to see that there is a group of people, no matter how small or big, who are living in this case Birmingham, apparently. And I know now I'm falling into the trap of, you know, how some newspapers would portray this. But it does antagonize people to see people on benefits holding at the same time several iPhones, smoking endless cigarettes, massive television screens, Adidas tracksuits, whilst... You know, the majority of people actually get up in the morning and strive to make their own way in life. It does antagonise people.
Yeah, exactly. It does antagonise people, and is it productive or even well-balanced to antagonise people with these images at a time where certain political movers and shakers are seeking to do exactly that, to antagonise the populace about a minor social problem and to package it as the absolute hobbler of our country when it absolutely isn't that. That's what I'm saying. You won't find me suggesting that somebody complaining they don't have enough money while staring at an iPhone has got a priority difficulty. Mm. Of course not. But to put that up on a large dirigible over the country so everybody can point at it is a failure of the responsibility of documentary makers. Unless alongside that you demonstrate that this is actually a minor issue, so an issue that needs to be addressed, but not the be-all and end-all of the welfare state. And they didn't do that.
Just in case anybody wants to not only watch the rest of the series, but find out what life is really like on James Turner Street. Yesterday, the Independent newspaper ran a story of a two-bedroomed house for sale on James Turner Street. It's on sale at the moment for £77,000. It's been on sale for 5 months. Can't get a buyer. It's been reduced from £80,000. So if you want to live with Dee and Becky and Fungi, I'd say get your offers in now. £77,000, the house for sale in James Turner Street. This was Benefit Street on Channel 4 on Monday at 9 p.m. It's part of a series. It was narrated by Tony Hurst and directed by Peter Strachan for Love Productions for Channel 4. And what I'm hearing is that the Magnus, the people of James Turner Street are all gathered together in the street and saying, "That's enough about us now. We've heard enough. Let's." They want to know what our selections are for the pretend iPod.
Of course they did,
this
yes.
week. This is their main priority
and the
of the day.
Is because it's tea.
Yes. I wonder if they have Waitrose loyalty cards in James Turner Street.
Oh, I hope so. I'd put the cat amongst the pigeons, wouldn't it?
The pretend iPod is where we both select a piece of music. It's a growing playlist. It's a huge playlist. We've been doing this for a couple of years. And we place these songs on a massive playlist on the Rocking Vicar website. It has its little tab there. You can see the tracks we've picked and listen to as many as you like. One, none, all. And it's also available on Spotify through my colleague over there, Magnus Shaw. It's under his name. Look, there he is, just over there. So... we'll add a couple of tracks to that now. 1974, there I was in a small office in Paddington, chain-smoking myself through constant tonsillitis, pharyngitis.
Which Paramore you were on at this point?
Oh, no, I'm not going to mention Paramore today.
Oh, I see.
Today.
You measured your life out in various eccentric girlfriends usually, don't you?
I do, but I'm not going to feature one today. So, no, I was chain-smoking myself through all this tonsillitis, pharyngitis, laryngitis. Who was I going out? I was going out with Lynn at the
there
time, by the way. My first major love.
C.S. Eliot and his coffee spoons for Terence DeConn's girlfriend.
I know. She was my first major love.
Aww.
And... anyway, there I was smoking 60 cigarettes a day and spending my hours on the phone booking bands onto London's pub rock circuit, Kilburn on the High Roads with the never happy Ian Dury, a bit of a misery, I have to say, and Charlie Gillett popping into the office asking us to give Dury another chance. He was kind of managing them at the time. Chilly Willy and the Red Hot Peppers with Andrew Jakeman, later to reinvent himself as Jake Riviera, as their manager, coming in to be loud and a bit scary, I have to say,
mate,
to the 18-year-old me, yes. Bees Make Honey, Ducks Deluxe, Bringsley Swartz, all of these bands were regulars on the pub rock scene, playing on wooden pallets as stages at the Hope and Anchor, the Brecknock, the Nashville and the Dublin Castle. Most of the pubs run by burly Irish landlords who were reasonably happy to give the bands 20 to 25 quid a night as they pulled in the punters who collectively spent 10 times that amount on booze. Now, many of these acts were playing 5, 6, even 7 nights a week at the height of pub rock, and some landlords even ran a Sunday lunchtime slot where the bands would play 2 sets either side of the strippers' routine.
Yes.
Yes, it was very common. That
I once had, exactly that gig as a DJ, doing the records between the strippers. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
I can remember being with the Ducks Deluxe in one of those, but I think it may have been the Brecknock, actually, where they did a Sunday lunchtime slot. Nobody interested. All the men around the bar wanted to see the stripper, and when she finished, many of them drifted away, leaving Ducks Deluxe playing their second set to about 3 people.
Yes, I think that was my experience, too, as the DJ.
Because they played so regularly, many of these bands became very accomplished indeed, but their sound, it was really so rarely be transferred to a recording studio, and despite several gaining quite a following in the London pubs, they just couldn't reproduce that appeal on record. Now, one exception, and they only had a brief moment in the sun, really, was the band Ace. Very familiar figures at these 20 quid a night gigs. They had a great lineup of musicians who gelled together wonderfully in the pub rock setting. The jewel in their crown was the singer and keyboard player Paul Carrack. And I can still see and hear him now in my mind singing today's featured song at the Tally Ho Pub in Camden. I remember it well. Paul Carrack wrote the song that would, to all intents and purposes, be the only hit single to emerge from pub rock. And it came from the album that they recorded at Rockfield Studio in Wales. Much of the album features the country rock that seemed to resonate through much of the pub rock genre, but How Long stands out with its soft, soulful groove and its slightly mournful lyrics, which are so often misunderstood and assumed to be aimed at a cheating partner of love. Blue-Eyed Soul, it was called at the time, and if Ace could have held it together and set off on an average white band groove, they could have been contenders, as they say. As it turned out, How Long was their only hit, and they split up soon afterwards. Yet it remains a glorious legacy of the pub rock years, and in particular, a singer and writer in Paul Carrack, who was destined to move in spheres very way beyond the pint-nursing patrons of Islington and Kentish Town. Released in 1974, reaching number 20 on the UK Top 40, number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100, 3 minutes, 9 seconds, Ace, How Long?
Yeah, and of course it's a song that he still performs. There was I in a scorching hot field in Oxfordshire last summer watching him do exactly that. So from the dingy boozers of North London to a rather splendid field in Oxfordshire, he's still singing that song and it still sounds great. If it isn't about catching your lover dallying with other partners, what on earth is it about? Because it seems to be exactly that.
Oh, it's about the bass player who was secretly moonlighting with the Sutherland Brothers and Quiver.
Oh, really?
And they thought he was going to leave the band. He did leave for a little while, but then came back and actually, funnily enough, then plays on the recording of the song that is about him. How Long?
It can't escape to Mr. Carrack that it had that a double meaning, though, as a bitter love song, surely.
Perhaps, yeah. Perhaps I think it's largely and almost always interpreted that way by
absolutely.
People who not only hear it, but I think many of the people who've covered it have probably assumed that. But no, of course it isn't. It's about the bass player having a little stint with the Sutherland Brothers and Quiver.
Of course, Paul Carrack, yet another horny-handed son of Sheffield. So many musicians from that city. Good pick. And everybody knows that song instantly. From the first two bass notes.
That wonderful, just simple bass line, and then Carrack's keyboards come in, and it's just, it's wonderful, because it takes 32 seconds for the vocal to come in. And I imagine that today, you know, your producers of your Beyoncés and whatever say, oh God, you know, we can't have that slow, slow intro. We've got to, you know, really make that perk up a bit.
Exactly, yes. But of course, we all know it's... you're part of what makes it such an eternal song. Yeah. Funnily enough, bass lines figure heavily in my pick too. Okay. Let's go back to 1990 and the soul number one from Norman Cook's pre-Fatboy Slim band, Beats International, was jollying up the nation in the midst of that other recession, which actually, looking back on it now, looked like a wealth bonanza, didn't it? with that stirring bass line, of course, from The Clash's Guns of Brixton, and the even more stirring harmonica theme from The Good, Bad and the Ugly, is a terrific record. Everything's thrown in there, and yet it all coheres together to make a wonderful whole. Although... that said, I never did learn to do the boss walk. I must put some more practice into that. But funnily enough, the biggest borrow didn't come from Paul Simonon or Sergio Leone for the song Dub Be Good To Me, but from a lesser-known talent, the SOS Band. Now, for the SOS Band, Just Be Good To Me was a hit in 1993, and that is a typo, 1983, and was the only chart record by the SOS Band. However, its success was pretty much assured, as it was written and produced by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. So for younger listeners, they were sort of the Neptunes of their day. In the early 80s, Jam and Lewis were nothing less than walking hit machines. Look at what they did for Janet Jackson. But why is this going on the pretend iPod? What is it to do with our playlist? Well, sometimes it doesn't really do to examine a record too closely, lest that magic flutter away. Suffice to say, Just Big to Me has quality 80s soul written through every stanza. And a solid noise it is too, with crashing fuzz guitars enveloping a studded slap bass. But none of this would be worth a dime if it wasn't simply a superbly written and crafted pop single, the kind they don't really seem to make anymore. Unless I disperse the magic, I think I'll leave it there and heartily recommend the SOS Band's Just Be Good to Me to you and to the pretend iPod.
I love this song. And you know what it reminds me of? It was 1983, particularly 1984, of all people, Tony Blackburn was doing a wonderful daily weekday show on BBC Radio London.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
I remember it well.
It was all soul and Motown. Yeah. And, of course, you know, you'd never get that on a BBC local station now. And he picked all the records himself, and he was given completely free range. And do you know what? People might now, you know, who perhaps younger than I say, Tony Blackburn, oh, yeah, you know, he's that bloke from I'm a Celebrity or whatever. And, you know, he was probably 40 then, I suppose, or close to 40 then. But it was his sheer dynamism of enthusiasm for this music. And I used to look forward to listening to his show every day. I was writing for BBC shows at the time, so I had plenty of time to contemplate life. And I used to love listening to his show. And it featured so many of these songs, like the SOS Band, Shalimar, and so on. And I particularly remember Just Be Good to Me. And as I say, it was the music, but also Tony Blackburn's absolutely lifelong passion for soul music and Motown. And it was just an inspirational run. It was the best shows he's ever done, certainly since the pirate radio days. Yeah. Absolutely tremendous. And so that's what this song always reminds me of. Of course, wonderful vocalist Mary Davis, who sings on this. And as you say, an early example of the production team, Jimmy Jam and Terry
absolutely.
Lewis.
Absolutely. I think people forget that about Tony Blackburn. Or perhaps more truthfully, they don't even know it about Tony Blackburn. But he's an absolute aficionado on soul music, like world authority on soul music, isn't it? That kind of gets lost in his sort of toothy 1970s Top of the Pops image, doesn't it? But there's nobody to hold a candle to him on soul music.
Absolutely. Exactly. He's the most knowledgeable. And as I say, he's absolutely in love with that music, and it's what I think he's at his best and at his most enthusiastic and at his most listenable when he's actually given free rein to pick his own records and you know, just run it with his passion.
Somebody should give that boy a soul show.
They should.
Absolutely. But he's fair dinkum on Pick of the Pops, but he should have his own soul show, because that's where
he's transformed. Yeah, he's transformed, absolutely. As you say, from the sort of housewife's favourite of the 1960s and early 70s into this absolute expert who knows probably every soul song, every Northern soul, every Tambla song, every Philly song, every Stax record made since the since you know 1950.
Yeah, he's got a Clark Kent Superman thing going on there, hasn't he? Well, bingo, that's another couple of fat joints, as I believe the young people say, making their way onto the pretend iPod. And sadly, it's our cue to head downstairs, give the carrots a stir, and serve out some tiny little cups of Tizer. So thanks to my fine colleague, Terence Dackham.
Okay, I am going to leave slowly.
Yes.
To see you next
Let's
week.
Slow down. An extra thanks to you. You're still our favourite listener. Please join us again in 7 days. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shore media production.
People have to do what they have to do to exist.
Oh, don't ever give you money to get a can.
I'm going to get you 50p though.
No, that's on me, that is.
Hello, can you
Channel 4 shows what life is really like for the residents of Benefits Street.